I'm Crystal Chavez, in for Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Allegations of domestic abuse are causing problems for Alan Grayson's run for the U.S. Senate. The report surfaced Tuesday, first reported by Politico. In it, police reports stating that Grayson hit his now ex-wife, Lolita. There are four reports stretching from 1994 to 2014. When confronted by a Politico reporter, Grayson didn't answer any questions. Instead, said the reporter was in his way and needed to be arrested by Capitol Police. Grayson's attorney says the reports are politically motivated. The congressman is running for Senate and faces Patrick Murphy, Pam Keith, and others in a contentious primary race. In the wake of the news story, progressive groups distanced themselves from Grayson, pulling their endorsements, and four staffers left the campaign. Will the allegations derail Grayson's campaign? Is this politically motivated? Is politics getting too personal? And how do voters navigate their way through allegations of domestic violence by a politician? Join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Or send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. Joining me in the studio, Frank Torres, publisher of the Orlando Political Observer. Frank, welcome back.
Good morning.
Also, Catherine Welch, news director here at WMFE. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
And joining us from St. Petersburg, Tamara Lush, reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
The allegations shaking up the congressman's campaign for Marco Rubio's Senate seat. Grayson has been locking horns with Patrick Murphy in a contentious primary. Grayson's attorney says the release was politically motivated. Freelance journalist Mark Pinsky has been following the Grayson campaign since the start, and he agrees.
And this, to me, has all the hallmarks of a precision drone strike from the powers that be in the National Democratic Party. Why now? Why during the convention? All the police records are ready. I don't think that Lolita Grayson on her own would have emailed Politico, of all people, organizations at this time, unless there was some sort of sinister hand guiding her.
Frank, bring us up to speed. What's happened between these two in the past?
Well, you know, there's been a long record of controversy between Alan Grayson and his former wife, Lolita Grayson. That's, you know, that stretches back a couple of years ago to a scene involving an altercation at their front door during their separation, which was videotaped on a cell phone and a very emotional and physical exchange between the two. And their whole separation and ultimate annulment sort of played out in front of the media because of Alan Grayson's status as a congressman and one of the most controversial figures in all of American politics. And now all these allegations have surfaced up from Lolita Grayson, alleging domestic abuse throughout the course of their marriage, which lasted quite a long bit. And all of this is happening in the middle of a Florida competitive Democratic primary in the Florida Senate race. So all these things are coming out here in the heat of the political election season, and there are still a lot of facts that still need to be sorted out.
The race has been contentious, as you said, and it was getting close. Bring us up to speed on the Murphy-Grayson race before this week.
Well, what you basically have is the pick of the establishment, as you will, or the party in Patrick Murphy. Patrick Murphy's been endorsed by President Barack Obama, Vice President Joe Biden, and multiple party leaders. And some of those party leaders, like Harry Reid, have openly said to Alan Grayson that they want him to lose. So this has put Alan Grayson really sort of pitted him as the – titled him as the ultimate outsider in this race, with him having to sort of – having to go after the having to garner the far-left progressives for support to try to remain competitive. And so far, it has been a competitive primary.
Catherine?
Yeah, and I'd like to get hear Frank's opinion on this. You know, a week ago, Patrick Murphy was getting beaten up. The CBS station in Miami did this piece on him where he was a CPA, but not really. He owned a business, but not really. His dad bought it for him, and it was a defunct business. And you sort of saw in the polls, the last polls being taken, taken that Grayson and Murphy were kind of within spitting distance. So here at the time, the worst thing that came out about Alan Grayson was the ethics probe. And here Patrick Murphy got about as much bounce as he could possibly get from the endorsements of the president of the United States, the woman running for president of the United States. And yet they were still in spitting distance. And you have to wonder, like Mark Pinsky says, about the timing of this. We're just about 3 or so weeks away from the August 30th primary. And did the Democratic Party freak out and say Alan Grayson could be our candidate? And were they holding this in their pocket and did a drone strike just in time to create enough damage before Grayson could spin it?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility. I think these things are everything is planned throughout the course of these campaigns. And despite all the controversy involving Alan Grayson, the countless sound bites you could use that don't always reflect him in a positive manner, the two have been leapfrogging in the polls with no clear frontrunner in this Democratic race. So I certainly wouldn't put the claims of Mr. Pinsky's claims out of reach. It is very possible that these things are timed and planned to move the needle on this very competitive primary.
This isn't the first time Grayson's now ex-wife, Lolita, was in the news. The couple had public domestic abuse allegations in the past, as y'all been talking about. Nasty and quite public divorce. The latest reports include photos of bruises on Lolita Grayson. Here's what Grayson's attorney, Mark Najem, had to say about those bruises.
I think people don't realize is that she's been in martial arts for years and years and years. So to have her with bruises on her body regularly is a normal course. That's what happens when people are in regular ongoing karate or taekwondo or whatever her martial art discipline was at the time.
Kat, you've been covering Alan Grayson. What do you make of his reaction to the Politico reporter earlier this week, that video that's gone viral?
So the video you're referencing is there was a media gaggle, obviously, around Grayson after the story broke. There are allegations of jostling between the reporter and Grayson. That was not caught on camera. But what was caught on camera was Alan Grayson losing his cool on this political reporter, which then can be used as evidence that, yes, in fact, he is a bully. He bullies reporters around. That said, what I found fascinating is we're not hearing from Grayson. We're hearing from his attorney, his divorce attorney, Mark Najem. He's responding instead of Grayson holding a press conference saying, I did not do this. I suspect that perhaps he is putting his attorney out there. So there can't be any political ads of Alan Grayson saying, I did not hit my wife.
Grayson seemed to rise from similar bad press in the past. Do you think he can make it out of this one unscathed?
You know, 4 reports in 2 different states spanning over 20 years. You know, maybe if it were 1 report or just claims without police reports. But when you have Grayson again, you know, hiding behind his attorney, so to speak, putting his attorney out there, his attorney is saying that he didn't do the hitting. He was the one being hit. It's very messy. Plus, you have the mass exodus now of 4 staffers, one being his political director, the 3 others field directors. This is the 2nd time his campaign has lost staffers. It just at some point, it just starts tipping the scales.
Tamara, Grayson is known for being an outspoken and progressive congressman representing Central Florida. Is that how people across the state see him?
Well, I think that Grayson is known to some outside his district, particularly because of his floor speech, where he said the Republican plan for health care was don't get sick, and if you do get sick, you die. And I think he drew vast amounts of flack from Republicans because of that and other antics, including one where he called his opponent, Dan Webster, Taliban Dan. But really, the issue for him is that he trumpets himself as a progressive, so this allegation that he hit his ex-wife runs counter to that.
Both Grayson's attorney and, as we heard, Mark Pinsky say this was a coordinated attack. What do you make of those allegations, Tamara?
Well, I suspect that it will have great impact on voters who don't know him, especially for those who don't, who know little about him. And the whole saga of his marriages, his relationship with his now wife while still married to Lolita, his divorce, the allegations of domestic violence, the fact that his current wife is running for his old seat, that's a lot of baggage and spells potential trouble to people who aren't familiar with him. And also, of course, the reason the news is bad for him is because it shuts down endorsements, it turns off donors, and he's already running against the establishment candidate.
Frank, the Progressive Change Campaign Committee and Democracy for America pulled their endorsements of Grayson. How important were those progressive endorsements to his campaign?
You know, they were very important, not so much because of the endorsements themselves, but they were very controversial endorsements when they first were announced. And when those organizations decided to endorse Alan Grayson over the party favorite, Patrick Murphy, they also put themselves out on a limb as an entirety of an organization and the whole infrastructure of the Democratic Party. So for them to retract these endorsements, which an act itself is, which is never a positive thing, it says a lot about the gravity and the seriousness of the of these allegations.
Alan Grayson has linked himself with his new wife, Dina, voicing her commercials for her run for his congressional seat. Is her campaign now tarnished because of these allegations?
You know, that is the million-dollar question. If people are, you know, have said she could win based on the fact that they share a last name, well, now if his last name is Mudd, does that then shine off on him? And is Susanna Randolph, his former district director, the big winner in this, who's running against his current wife?
Yeah, you know, that's a question that really needs to, that we're really going to find out a lot in a couple of days. All these candidates have done polling. Dina Grayson's polling implicates that she does have a lead because of that name identification. Now, is that lead going to take a drop with the Grayson name being dragged through all this negative publicity? It certainly is a possibility.
Have we heard anything from her campaign yet?
Silence. I follow the District 9 race every day, and all we've seen since this news broke is one fundraising email with no mention whatsoever of Alan Grayson. I will say that a lot of their literature, in addition to the commercials, does also feature Alan Grayson because of the name ID that has been linked to poll well with District 9 voters.
Have we heard anything from the Patrick Murphy campaign yet?
Oh, I think they're staying far, far away from this.
Yeah, there are topics in politics that are toxic, you know, almost by proximity. And there is nothing they could say or add to this existing dialogue that could potentially backfire on them as opposed to possibly put them in a position of risk.
Coming up, the Democratic National Convention wrapped up last night with Hillary Clinton officially accepting the nomination. During speeches all this week, the Pulse shooting was part of the political rhetoric. Will Democrats continue to focus on tightening gun control? And now that the two major parties have nominated their candidates, what kind of campaign focus will they put on Florida? We're taking your calls, 1-866-338-5252. We want to hear from you, 1-866-338-5252. Those stories and more when Intersection continues.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Florida Hospital, treating patients when a medical emergency strikes in 10 emergency rooms throughout Central Florida, including the newest location in Lake Mary on Reinhardt Road. Florida Hospital provides a network of care to help treat cardiac and stroke patients when every second counts. More information is available at floridahospital.com/ER.
Good morning. I'm Nicole Creston. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. Thanks for joining us on your Friday. Take us with you anywhere you go throughout the day by downloading the WMFE mobile app. Just search WMFE in the App Store or Google Play Store.
Support for 90.7 News comes from Webster University Orlando, a private nonprofit university offering a variety of graduate business degree programs for adults. Now in new facilities downtown across from the Amway Center. Information on all graduate degrees is available online at grad.webster.edu.
Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez. Joining me in the studio, Frank Torres, publisher of the Orlando Political Observer. Frank, welcome back.
Thank you.
Catherine Welch, news director here at WMFE. Catherine, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And joining us from St. Petersburg, Tamara Lush, reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks.
The Democratic National Convention wrapped up last night with Hillary Clinton officially accepting the nomination. But the start of the conference was a bit rocky, to say the least. Bernie Sanders supporters were upset after a leak of DNC emails showed the committee favored Clinton as their nominee. Sanders fans booed the DNC chair, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, during a breakfast. She's stepped down from her post. But that didn't quell the vocal Bernie supporters. At a conference calling for unifying the party, the crowd was audibly polarized at the start of the week. Sanders addressed delegates across the country, including Florida delegates, calling for unity as a party against Donald Trump.
Our job in a difficult moment is to bring people together, not divide us up. Our job is to understand that climate change is real and to transform our energy system, not say that climate change is a hoax.
That audio was provided by Florida Delegate Ricky Lee. By the end of the week, do we see unity in the Democratic Party, Kat?
You know, so here's what's interesting. Going into the convention, so going all the way back to right before the Republican convention, I interviewed Rich Crotty, who has been a Republican delegate for Florida. I think this was his ninth convention. And I asked him, where does your support for Donald Trump stand? And his answer was, we need unity in our party, and my candidate is better than the other candidate. And then last week, I interviewed Ricky Lee, who provided this audio, and this is his first convention. He is a Bernie fan. Now, you can't get much different than Rich Crotty than Ricky Lee. But when I asked him, where does your support for Hillary Clinton stand, he gave me nearly the exact same answer. Our job is unity, and my candidate is better than the other candidate. I feel like these two would have a wonderful chat over coffee, that they perhaps would find that they have more in common this election than they have differences. And I think that's a problem for both parties. When your delegates are like, yeah, it's a time for unity and I don't really like my candidate, but better than the other one, I think that's a problem.
Ricky Lee, if you're listening, tape that conversation for us. Frank, the Florida delegates of Bernie applauded their support of him. More importantly, the fact, though, that young people are getting involved in the political process. Do you think this wave of support will make it to November?
I think the majority of the wave of support will still make it to November. You know, it was a transition from those boos that we heard on Monday morning, both at the delegate breakfast for Debbie Wasserman Schultz and the opening hours of the convention, to a general consensus and a pleasant environment for Hillary Clinton. But there are still some people out there. There are still some stragglers out there that are still upset over the entire process. They're upset over the emails. They're upset that their guy didn't get a fair shake. And let me tell you, Bernie Sanders supporters are probably the most passionate group of voters, especially here in Central Florida, where we've had a chance to cover all the campaigns, that you'll find out there. They love this man. And you saw that on the floor with people in tears during his speech and during all references of his name. So there's still more work to do, but I do believe that the party in general moved in the right direction and set the right tone heading into the general election.
Tamara, Sanders mentioned climate change as a campaign platform. How big of an issue is climate change and sea level rise to Floridians?
Climate change and sea level rise should be a big issue for Floridians, and it does seem that more people are paying attention each year. A St. Leo University poll in April found a big increase since last year in the percentage of Floridians concerned about global climate change. And recently, there's been a spate of studies. Just this week, a study was released that said by 2050, the naval bases at Key West and Jacksonville could lose 20% of their land to changing tides. And also, recently, another study showed that in 30 years, the grounds of Mar-a-Lago, Donald Trump's Palm Beach mansion, could be under at least a foot of water for more than 210 days a year because of tidal flooding. And then, of course, there's the algae bloom, the sludgy guacamole-like substance that's plaguing parts of the state, and experts warn that we'll only see more of these dangerous blue-green algae blooms as global temperatures rise in Florida and nationwide.
You can join the conversation. We're at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. Send us a tweet with your question or comment at WMFE Orlando. Now that we've had both conventions, Catherine, what are you watching for as the candidates make their swing through Florida?
I'm going to look at where Florida's, how Florida's Hispanic community reacts to both candidates. You know, firstly, I'm going to look to see if Marco Rubio, little Marco, stumps with Trump. Will he come out for his party and be a team player, or will he keep himself at arm's length? He only appeared at the convention via video, so there's that. Also going to look at what effect of having Governor Rick Scott managing Trump's super PAC. Will being tied to Trump be good for Scott, or will Trump being tied to Scott be bad for Trump? Floridians have a mixed reaction to Governor Scott. Voters have a mixed reaction to Donald Trump. How are they going to rub off on each other? How are they going to campaign? I'm also going to look at Hispanic voters, especially looking at a recent Wall Street Journal NBC poll showed 76% of them are for Hillary. Donald Trump has now twice postponed meetings with Hispanic leaders in Miami. But at the same time, can you guarantee that the Hispanic vote will go to Hillary? And I'm sure that's something Frank can speak more about than I can, because you've been really watching this.
Yeah, you know, I think Hillary definitely has the early advantage with Hispanic voters. The message is a little bit more appealing to the community, and her running mate speaks Spanish, which is, opens up a whole other dimension for her campaign.
But does that matter that he throws a line out here or there in Spanish, or is it kind of an eye roll, like, oh, good grief, he's trying to be one of us?
You know, a little bit of both. You know, he comes off a little bit corny at sometimes, but people appreciate the general knowledge and the effort it takes to learn the extra language.
Tamara, what are you going to be watching for?
Oh, I think that I'll be also watching how stricter gun laws and the Pulse shooting, I think that will also play into this as well.
During speeches all this week, the Pulse shooting was part of the message, calling for love, not hate, and stricter gun laws. Christine Leinonen's son, Christopher, and his boyfriend, Juan Guerrero, were killed during the shooting last month. She spoke at the DNC Wednesday, talking about the day she went into labor with Christopher. She was a Michigan State trooper, and the medical staff took her gun and put it in a safe.
I'm glad common sense gun policy was in place the day Christopher was born. But where was that common sense the day he died?
Leinonen on stage with two Pulse survivors endorsed Clinton. Frank, what do you make of the Pulse theming at the convention? Did it resonate with you?
You know, I actually got to watch that part of the convention at a Hillary watch party. And at that party, everybody stopped what they were doing to hear these comments. And it was the most powerful part of that evening and one of the most powerful parts of the campaign. A lot of people remember that footage during the Pulse shooting, wondering, you know, asking and begging for more information about her son. And just to see it come around in this dimension, I believe, had extra emotional impact around an already intense and emotional subject in gun control.
Tamara, you've been reporting on another mass shooting, the one in Fort Myers. Bring us up to speed on that story.
17 people were shot outside of Club Blue in Fort Myers early Monday morning. It was a teen event. Two kids were killed. One was an 18-year-old basketball star. One was a 14-year-old. There have been no arrests as of this morning, but the police did arrest three on unrelated charges and said they might be persons of interest in the case. And as of yesterday, the local newspaper, the Fort Myers News Press, which covered the shooting very well, was already running an op-ed imploring readers not to forget about the victims. So think about that. 17 people were shot, two teens are dead, and the newspaper has to remind people not to forget about the mass shooting. And that's what we've come to in this country, how commonplace mass shootings have become. And that's why I said that that's what I'll be watching for in almost every race, I think, how people and how candidates will handle gun issues and the mass shooting events that have happened this year.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller, Jessica in Ocoee. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hey, I was just curious about how viable a third-party option is for this election when you have a train wreck like Trump and someone who has an obviously checkered past like Hillary Clinton running. Are we really stuck with just two parties for this election, or is somebody like a Johnson-Weld Libertarian ticket an option now?
That is an excellent question. I think you said the two magic names in that statement. A lot of people are looking at a third-party option because you have a group of Democrats that were upset at with the way the whole situation with the DNC emails played out. They're looking for another option. Then you have the Never Trumps on the other side, the Republican side, that will never vote for Donald Trump. And I've been following the communications from the Libertarian Party who have really established themselves as a third option with former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson and former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld. And they're really out front, man. Are you a Bernie supporter? Try Gary Johnson and Bill Weld. Never Trump? Look at Gary Johnson and Bill Weld. And it's kind of funny, but at the same time appealing because the Libertarian message has a lot of widespread appeal, but hasn't found the right messenger to really bring in that kind of support.
And I have a question, Frank. Do you feel that the Green Party candidate Jill Stein gets a bump in the wake of the email scandal?
I believe she will get a bump, even though her candidacy is being vigorously shoved away by some Democratic opinion leaders out there. A lot of people will definitely look at her candidacy as another option. But, you know, these third-party options are really have the opportunity of playing spoiler. And who knows, if this anti-establishment sentiment picks up, Gary Johnson could even make it up to a debate stage. He still has a little bit of a climb to go. But the third-party option is definitely in play. And believe me, both the Clinton and Trump campaigns have their eyes on it.
Jessica, thanks for your call. We have another caller here. John wants to talk about Hillary Clinton. John, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We can hear you just fine.
Okay, my name is actually Eric Morgan. I think you got the name wrong there. But and actually, I'm Twitter friends with Tamara Lush, who's a fantastic writer as well as a journalist. But
hi, thanks. Thank you.
Sorry about getting your name wrong there.
that's okay. She knows me as at Space Coast Law, but
it's nice to finally talk to you.
Yes. Anyway, I just wanted to comment on the DNC. I'm a lifelong Democrat who will be voting for Jill Stein. And, you know, I think that, you know, the Dems have really tried hard to take the focus away from the issues on why people don't like Hillary, to try to make it about, you know, some problem with the fact that she's a woman or some problem with her personality. I like her personality. And I like Hillary Clinton, but she's, you know, she's chosen to be the first openly open supporter of mass surveillance, you know, in Democratic candidate history. You know, she supports surveillance against, you know, American citizens without reasonable suspicion of a crime. She supports a ground war in Syria after 15 years of war. She's chosen to move the Dem platform sharply to the right, and she's divided the Democratic Party. And that's why many Dems are going to be voting with the Greens this year.
John, thanks for raising that point about this fracturing. Catherine, what do you think about what he had to say there?
You know, we heard that a lot from Bernie supporters right at the beginning of the convention during the email leak, and pretty much throughout it seems that as Frank was saying, Jill Stein really offers an alternative to people who maybe don't completely square with Hillary Clinton's view on the issues as much as they did on Bernie's, and they're not quite ready to give up their passionately held beliefs and pledge their allegiance to Hillary, and they're looking for options.
We've heard a lot of calls, you know, after past mass shootings, Newtown, Fort Hood, but there never seems to be any movement. And the question always comes up, are these two Florida shootings now going to be a catalyst for change, Frank?
No, they're not. I mean, it's an answer that frustrates a lot of people. But what we've come to realize is that both sides on the gun issue, those who are in favor of assault weapons bans, those who are in favor of measures like the no-fly, no-buy list that prohibits people on FBI watch lists from purchasing weapons, and the advocates for the other side of the issues that stand against those pushes, they're not going to budge. And it's a lot of it has to do with the current state of Washington, D.C. politics, with the two parties firmly entrenched, and they just won't move on gun control. And it was interesting, a point that was made up earlier, that people have to be reminded of these gun shootings. They're becoming more and more frequent, and unfortunately, people are becoming numb, and we're not seeing any really movement on this.
So here's what I'm going to be looking for. I think in Washington, good luck with that. But on a state level, we now have two shootings in two major cities. Also, don't forget with Pulse, this wasn't just a nightclub. It was a gay nightclub targeting the LGBT community. Never before has there been a shooting targeting a community that has a national apparatus that actually has a track record for affecting change on a national level with marriage equality. And so what I'm going to be looking for is, especially in Florida, is whether the LGBT community goes from having allies to being the ally in gun control and using their force, their network, all of the tools that they have at their disposal to really push this through, at least through Tallahassee.
There were calls for a special session just days after the Pulse shooting. That never panned out. Frank, what sense do we have that gun legislation will be taken up in the Florida legislative session? It starts in January, right?
That's correct. And there'll be gun legislation taken up, but it might not necessarily be in a direction of getting guns off the street as it will be to continue to add access to them, because you still have that basic philosophical difference of the mentality of these attackers versus the actual application of guns. So I suspect you'll see open carry be rolled out there in a legislative session again. Campus carry, you'll still see these issues come back. And it's just a matter of how they're defeated and by what margin they're defeated time after time.
And yet after shooting, public opinion goes up for gun control legislation.
Yeah, it's a true anomaly, on the opinion of the American voters.
I think two things are worth noting. And in this week, when I was in Fort Myers, I actually saw a sign for concealed weapons permit classes spring up in the parking lot of the club of Club Blue in the day after the shooting. And I think it's also worth noting that I've actually written about four mass club shootings this year. One weekend in February, I was working. Two people were shot and killed at a club in Tampa, and six or seven people were injured. The next day at a club in Orlando, two people were killed and 10 people were injured. Then in June, the Pulse shooting that killed 49, and now Fort Myers. That's 55 people dead in four shootings this year alone. And, I'm probably forgetting some other club shootings. And obviously, three of those four weren't terrorism-related like Orlando was, but still, 55 lives were lost, which is overwhelming to think about.
There are two town hall meetings next week to talk about the distribution of the One Orlando Fund. Kat, how's this process going to work?
So there's more than $20 million in the fund, and it looks like they're going to start handing it out shortly. They're going to wrap it all up by October 1st. The largest amount will be going to families of the 49 left dead, smaller amounts going to the injured and those were there. The amounts that will be parsed out hinge on how much will be left in the fund, how much is in the fund by September 26th, because that is when the disbursements begin. Now, there will be a town hall meeting that will be coming up on August 4th at the Amway Center. There's going to be two sessions. So there's going to be one at 12:30 during the day and then one at 6:30 in the evening. And we'll certainly get more details during that.
Frank, Mayor Dyer has been front and center during Pulse. How is he doing as a city leader?
I write about Mayor Dyer almost every single day, and I've been covering him for a long time. He's done a terrific job because unlike a lot of politicians who have taken this, especially in recent weeks, and made this political, his concern has always been about the city and the city providing the essential services it needs to keep the people safe. And it would have been – there were a lot of other politicians that would have taken this – the sentiment from this tragedy and, applied it to another purpose. But he's really been down the middle. He cares about the people and the victims. And, it's leadership that I think has drawn praise from every dimension I've seen. And as long as he continues to do that, I think the community will continue to recover.
And one thing he's said again and again, and this relates to the Pulse Fund, is transparency.
Even absolutely.
Trying to get as many of the police records out as possible in the wake of the legal tug of war over the 911 calls, but also in terms of this one fund. So he brought, you know, the fact that they snagged Kenneth Feinberg to help administer the fund. Also, they're working with the National Compassion Fund to do this. The word transparency has been released over and over again. They're making sure that none of the overhead costs will be paid for out of the fund. I think you're seeing him walking a very fine line to make sure that there's really just no margin for error and no room for criticism.
The city of Orlando says the cost of responding to the Pulse shooting, like police, overtime, pay for staff, is upwards of $2 million. How will the city pay for that?
Yeah, that was rolled out in the budget meeting this week, I believe. And the mayor, you know, sort of mentioned the readiness of the city to handle the cost of these tragedies through reserves. And there's also been a push in Washington, both by people like Congressman John Mica, who held a hearing with Jerry Demings and John Mina, to sort of reevaluate and reassess the threat matrix, which is used to distribute funding to different municipalities according to different tragedies and disasters that take place. And Orlando didn't qualify for a lot of that, simply for reasons that it wasn't a city with a port. It wasn't a city with, you know, certain identifiers which made it eligible for funding. So I think you're going to continue to see both that battle continue to be waged as well.
Yeah, and I do believe the city's portion was something like $600,000. And when you lump in the sheriff's office and a couple of other things, it topped that. And one of the things he said in his State of the Budget address is this is why we have a rainy day fund. Even in the tough days of the recession, when we had to trim here and nip here, but we never touched our reserves, this is why you have a reserve. And that actually federal dollars are starting to already repay some of that cost.
Memorials are coming down, and the Orange County Regional History Center is collecting artifacts. They're being preserved and stored in an undisclosed location for safekeeping. Kat, what's the plan for all of those mementos?
So our reporter Amy Green just met with folks from the History Center, and what they're doing is they're taking them all in, and they're organizing them in groups. So all of the banners, all of the signs, all of the candles. And they're breaking them up that way. And then what they're going to do is photograph and catalog. And eventually there will be an online log of just about everything except for the perishable goods that were left at the memorials across Orlando in the wake of the shooting. So you could type in photos and you'll see every photo. Teddy bear, you can see every teddy bear. And it will go on for generations to come to be able to sort of virtually see what was left at the memorials.
Tamara, were you seeing a similar outpouring of support in Fort Myers?
Well, there was a makeshift memorial outside of the club, but it was a very different scene, and I didn't get the impression that the entire community or the entire county was rallying around the victims of that shooting as in the Pulse shooting.
Are the leaders in Fort Myers looking to Orlando for guidance? You know, Orlando looked to Boston and their response to the marathon bombing.
Again, I didn't see that or I haven't heard anything like that, but I thought it was interesting that Pulse was on the mind of at least one Fort Myers woman prior to the shooting. Stephanie White, the mother of 18-year-old Stefan Strotter, the victim, she sat in her living room and she held a photo of her dead son and told me that she told him to look for all of the exits if any kind of shooting went off, to hit the floor, find a table, get out of the way, because she thought about the people in Orlando. I thought that was really powerful.
That is. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Crystal Chavez. I'm talking with Tamara Lush, reporter with the AP, Catherine Welch, news director at WMFE, and Frank Torres, publisher of the Orlando Political Observer. Coming up, the fight for expanding medical marijuana here in Florida. A bill signed into law is still facing challenges, and the effort to broaden the state's marijuana laws by a constitutional amendment just got more contentious. We'll tell you all about that. Breaking down the fight for legal medical marijuana, that's when Intersection returns.
Support for 90.7 News comes from UCF Health, where doctors who teach the next generation of doctors care for you. offering primary and specialty care from two locations, East Orlando and Lake Nona. UCF Health. We practice what we teach. UCFHealth.com.
Good morning. This is Intersection. I'm Nicole Creston. Thanks for joining us. In your forecast, partly sunny skies today, hot and humid with afternoon highs in the middle 90s and a 40% chance of scattered showers and storms moving in. Overnight lows in the upper 70s. Similar conditions for the weekend.
Support for 90.7 News comes from the Cornell Fine Arts Museum at Rollins College. Experience displacement, symbols and journeys, as well as the permanent collection featuring leading contemporary artists through European masters. The museum is open for all to enjoy. Details at rollins.edu/CFAM.
Welcome back to Intersection. I'm Crystal Chavez. Medical marijuana will be on Florida's November ballot as Amendment 2. This as a Florida dispensary, Trulieve, has finally made its first delivery of a low-THC medical marijuana strain. And the health department has approved a second company to start selling cannabis to eligible patients. Support for expanded medical marijuana use in Florida is up from 2014 when it was 2 percentage points shy of passage. Do you know how you're going to vote? Are you thinking of medical marijuana as a response to a medical condition? Are you opposed to Amendment 2? Weigh in right now by calling us at 1-866-338-5252. That number again, 1-866-338-5252. This is your public forum. Frank, what is different this year as Florida voters decide on marijuana for medicinal purposes?
I think you have a broader, potentially more friendly electorate paying attention this time than you did when it ran during a midterm in 2014. And I think that's the reason why it was rolled out again by the United for Care group that's championing this amendment, is because, you know, you'll get a more progressive turnout of voters, a more younger group of voters, even though they're going after older voters this time to sort of emphasize the medical benefits of the drug. So you have a different set of players that are going to determine the fate of this amendment in November, and I think that's why we're seeing it again.
And do you see law enforcement leaders who led the opposition last go around changing their minds?
You know, there's been a softening of positions through relaxed marijuana ordinances throughout the state. I don't think you'll see as strong opposition lining up as you did in 2014. I recall the last time this was on amendment in 2014, you had Grady Judd, the Polk County Sheriff, aggressively on television sort of fighting this at every turn. I'm not seeing that sort of resistance this time around. There is an aggressive campaign online to oppose this drug that's saying it's, or the amendment that's saying it's not really an improvement from what we saw in 2014. So there is opposition out there. It's just a matter of what we're seeing.
Local governments are taking matters into their own hands, with cities like Orlando decriminalizing small amounts of marijuana. Do you see other cities following suit, Catherine?
So far, there are about 31 cities across the country that have decriminalized small amounts of marijuana. I moved down here a year and a half ago from Providence, Rhode Island, which was one of them. And the argument from law enforcement was like, listen, when we pull over a car, if we see a tiny little roach in an ashtray, or we see a tiny little bit of marijuana, we have reason then to go into the trunk of the car and sometimes find bigger, badder substances going on. And that was sort of our gateway into leading into making arrest on higher charges. And now you're taking this tool away from us. So that's the argument from law enforcement. Unclear whether or not, you know, them not being able to proceed further, stopping a car with a small joint in the ashtray, whether that's really hampered them to be able to be effective members of law enforcement. At the same time, you're not really seeing widespread reports of, you know, establishments being busted into and all their Doritos taken. Like, this clearly has not caused any kind of bedlam. In fact, earlier this year, the Boston Globe sent a couple of reporters to Colorado, and the top line of their analysis is there have been no widely felt negative effects in a state that has legalized marijuana. So I don't think we're cooler heads are prevailing. We're not seeing the bedlam that was predicted. I think you're going to see more cities follow suit to Orlando.
And we have a caller. Gina is calling us. Actually, Gina is not on the line. Do you see Florida ever legalizing recreational marijuana, Catherine?
Oh, never say never. But, you know, there are four states, Colorado, Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. Maine and Nevada are looking at it as well. I think you need like a Massachusetts, a couple more liberal states come on board. Then I think you're going to need a couple of more states that are in the middle, like a Virginia. If it does, Florida is going to absolutely be one of the last states. We're just so diverse. And we have so many international tourists coming here. I'm not sure how that would play into the mix of having legalized marijuana and having a whole bunch of international tourists coming to visit. It's very messy. Never say never. Never thought Florida would pass same-sex marriage. So, you know, that's one for the fortune tellers.
Monavette Cordero just did a piece in the Orlando Weekly talking about how moms with sick children who have chronic seizures have taken matters into their own hands, if illegally, for the health of their kids. We know there were so many legal delays and red tape. Parents were tired of playing the waiting game. So even if voters say yes to Amendment 2 in November, will implementation of the legal medical marijuana distributing system be any faster now?
Yeah, well, I think municipalities were preparing for its passage in 2014. And you saw a lot of local governments already sort of preparing local ordinances on where the dispensaries were going to be, what was going to be the whole logistics behind the implementation of medical marijuana. And I think you're going to continue to see some of that more in the coming months as people start to realize that there is a possibility that this could potentially pass. So I think you'll see a lot of movement at the local levels to try to see examine an effective way to implement this should voters decide it should be a law.
Tamara, there is some opposition to Amendment 2. A family member behind Public Supermarkets donated to the group lobbying against the medical marijuana ballot initiative. What do you know about that?
This week, the Miami New Times, my old newspaper, reported that the trust of Carol Jenkins Barnett, the daughter of the founder of the Publix supermarket chain, donated $800,000 to the drug-free Florida group. So, and that's fighting the legalization measure on the ballot this November.
Moving on, marijuana to mosquitoes now. Breaking news, the Florida Department of Health has gathered enough information as part of its ongoing investigation into non-travel-related cases of Zika in Miami-Dade and Broward counties to conclude that a high likelihood exists that four cases are the result of local transmission. At this time, the department believes that active transmission of the Zika virus is occurring in one small area in Miami-Dade County. Are you pregnant or thinking about getting pregnant but worried about Zika? Have the headlines prompted you to make any changes? More bug spray, perhaps? Give us a call, 1-866-338-5252. Catherine, what's the latest on the total number of Zika cases here in Florida?
Sure. We're looking at about 383 cases. The four cases were found in South Florida, Miami-Dade, and Broward counties. So Florida certainly has a high number of cases now. There was no surprise, though. It was all pretty much suspected that sooner or later Florida would get a locally transmitted case, and it was likely going to be in that part of the state.
Frank?
Yeah, and you even had Human Health and Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell in Orange County on Monday touring the Orange County facility and examining readiness. And her position is from an insurance angle, a community that's prepared to tackle this that's properly insured and can have access to proper diagnostics behind the condition will be better prepared to combat the disease.
Tamara, what are blood collection companies doing to prepare for the possibility that, like we're seeing, of more Zika in Florida?
Well, yesterday, senior officials at the FDA said they have asked blood donation centers in Miami-Dade and Broward to stop collecting blood for the time being, and we'll see if that spreads to other counties, that halting of donations.
Frank, do you think there'll be a point where the Florida Zika situation starts to impact tourism to the Sunshine State?
That's what all the state leaders are looking at. As soon as it starts to hit the pocketbook, you're going to see an even more aggressive campaign to really get rid of this stuff. You know, if it affects Florida's reputation, Sterling reputation as a family-friendly destination, and that is challenged by this condition and this virus, you're going to see an aggressive push to really try to combat Zika.
And I'd just like to put this in perspective a little. Granted, the effects are horrible if you are a pregnant woman, but I had a friend come over last week. He didn't want to sit in my backyard because he was worried about Zika. This is a middle-aged man who does not have to worry about the health of his unborn child. So to put this in perspective, absolutely a very serious concern for women who are trying to get pregnant, thinking about getting pregnant or are already pregnant. But for the rest of the population, from what I understand, it's like a flu, I believe. So
right. Absolutely. And that those birth defects, they really hit you emotionally. And the images of microencephaly is a very, very powerful effect on people when they see it.
And just to wrap up the show on a different note, speaking of tourism, Catherine Welch, the Orlando Eye, now called the Coca-Cola Orlando Eye. What do you think of the corporate sponsorship for something like this, really quickly?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. I think I'm going to go to the Orlando Eye and then head over to the Citrus Bowl.
Not the Citrus Bowl. Now it's the
Camping World Stadium.
No, I'm going to the Orlando Eye and then I'm headed to the Citrus Bowl. I am Grandpa Simpson on this. This is what it is. Do not change the name.
Let's continue the conversations on Twitter. You can find us at WMFE Orlando. That's all the time for this week's Journalist Roundtable. I've been speaking with Tamara Lush, AP correspondent, Catherine Welch, WMFE's news director, and Frank Torres, publisher of the Orlando Political Observer. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and Florida Hospital. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our technical director is Nicole Creston. Production assistance this week from Adam Mano. Matthew Petty returns next week. I'm Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.